What's up and welcome to the NYC Video Podcast, a show about the film and video industry here in New York and the pros that are making it happen. I'll be your host, Tom Chavez, and each week I'll be interviewing other New York filmmakers to learn more about their craft, their process, and with a little luck, they'll share some stories and observations of working in production here in New York. Today I'll be talking with Becky Morrison, a New York-based filmmaker, producer, and entrepreneur that's worked on countless productions, from shorts and features to commercials and branded content. She's the founder of The Light, a rapidly growing production company that has produced spots for name brands like Star Wars, Lexus, NBC, Johnson & Johnson, to name a few. In addition to creating killer content for her clients, she and her team also are redefining how traditional productions take place. Becky and her employees work really hard to make sure that their crews are skilled, diverse, and think and act like a team rather than just a random gathering of freelancers. I've had the pleasure of working on her sets, and I can honestly say that it's unlike any other production experience I've ever been a part of. Throughout this episode, I'll talk to Becky to learn a little bit about her career path and what she and her teams do to make video productions a more inclusive and meaningful experience for their crews and clients. So without further ado, let's jump into today's interview with Becky Morrison after a quick word from this week's sponsor. Between wrangling actors, planning a crew move, or locking up a busy street corner in Midtown, communication is key when it comes to production. Hudson Radios is New York's premier walkie-talkie rental house. They're based in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and they provide industry-standard walkie-talkie kits, surveillance mics, wireless hotspots, routers, and more. You can pick up your order at their location, or they can deliver it to your set. For your next shoot, visit hudsonradios.com to see the equipment that they offer and fill out a simple estimate form for a quick and easy quote. You can also keep up with them on Instagram, at Hudson Radios, to stay informed of new pieces of gear that they provide to productions. When it comes to walkies and communication, Hudson Radios keeps you connected. Their links are in the show notes. And now, back to the show. Okay, so we have Becky Morrison today on the show. She's a fellow Brooklyn filmmaker, she's an entrepreneur, and she's also the executive producer and founder of The Light Production Company here in Brooklyn. How are you today?
Excellent. I'm so happy to be here with you, Tom. I adore you.
Thank you. You're making me blush already. So how have you been? We worked together a couple months ago, but in the meantime, what have you been up to?
Oh, let's see. Been up to a lot. We've really been very fortunate in that we've been expanding. So we're opening up the Light office in LA in July.
Congrats.
We've also been expanding our staff. Thank you. As a New Yorker, I definitely have like Hollywood dreams. I love the palm trees. I love the West Coast. So
absolutely.
We've just been working on projects. We do all sizes of projects, from like very big ones to smaller ones. So we've been doing all that recently.
Cool. And so are you originally from New York? Is that how you got into New York, or are you from elsewhere?
I did. I got into New York by being born here. I was birthed at Beth Israel Medical Center. My grandmother, my great grandmother, actually all from the Bronx. And so I was a first generation Manhattanite, but we're like old school New Yorkers in my family. So that is how I came to be in New York.
And how did you get into like film production?
Yeah, well, I always loved movies. My dad is a big cinephile. He doesn't work in the industry, but he always loved movies, like all those Turner classic movies, all the All About Eve and the black and white movies. And when I was younger, he used to quiz me about like movies. And so I always loved that growing up. I didn't really think of that as a potential career. I was very interested in social justice work. I wanted to work in criminal justice reform. And so I went to college thinking I would major in that. And the college that I was at didn't have that major. And then I guess I realized that I could major in film production. And I was like, wait a minute. I could watch movies all day, get a degree. This seems like a great hustle. And so I ended up I went to Boston for a year, and then I transferred to NYU and I went to film school there.
Okay, cool. When you graduated from NYU, did you have a film production or film studies? What was your major?
Film and TV production. So I wasn't in the cinema studies department, I was in the production department.
And when you left college, do you feel like college did a pretty good job at preparing you for working in the industry, or was it just mostly technical stuff and then you had to learn the business end of things on your own, I guess?
Yeah, I would say no, college didn't particularly prepare me for working in the industry. I think it prepared me in some ways, and I would say not actually in technical ways, but in more theoretical ways around story structure and narrative and how to really look at a movie. I think that was a big thing in understanding, being able to watch a movie and say, okay, I didn't like this movie because of the writing, right? As opposed to before I went to film school, it was just like, I didn't like that movie. But film school gave me the ability to discern exactly what was right or off in my opinion about certain movies. So being able to say, wow, the directing was amazing, but the cinematography was bad, you know, I think it gave me that ability. In terms of what I actually do now and went on to do after film school, I don't think that university like prepared me in any way for that at all. And not really in terms of production, you know, I didn't learn a lot about that. Sorry, NYU. Sure.
No, well, that's like the ongoing trend of or theme that I keep hearing about people that finished film school or went to film school, that, you know, you do learn like a lot of the technical stuff, but you don't really learn like the day to day hustle, the marketing, the networking that goes into it and all that stuff. So it's definitely a different skill set that I think you pick up after school, whereas like the foundation, the basics, the ability to read a film, I think that's kind of what the schools excel at and teaching students.
Absolutely. And I think there's so much that goes into being in this industry. You know, it's hard to prepare everyone in every job that they could possibly go on to do in the film industry, because you can work in development, or you can work at an agency, or you could be a gaffer, or, you know, there's so many different things. And I don't think film school can really prepare you for all of those things equally. And I think especially when it came to working in production, that what I learned from being there on set, starting at the bottom, listening, making mistakes, you know, and learning that way.
And speaking of the bottom, I guess, once you finished school, what was like the first job that you got? Was it like as a production assistant, or what was the first paid gig, I guess, that you landed?
It was as a production assistant. And I had a friend, I wanted so badly to get onto set. You know, I always see the honey wagons and, you know, the motorhomes. Yeah. You know, growing up in New York, you always see that. And I was like, God, it just felt impenetrable. Like I wanted to be inside of that, and I couldn't figure out how to get in. And I had a friend who was a production assistant. Actually, her dad was an AD in LA. She was a production assistant in New York. And there was a job she got a call for that she couldn't do. And she was like, would you like me to recommend you? And I was like, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So she recommended me. And I remember the coordinator called. It was a commercial. And she was like, so are you a set PA or are you an office PA? I was like, yeah, whatever you need. I'm that. And she was like, oh, okay. I was like, I didn't actually know what the difference was. And so she ended up bringing me into the office. And as soon as I got into the office, I felt like it was such a match for my personality. I really found a home being in the production office. So I did that one job. It was a Funkmaster Flex Ford commercial. After that job, there was another Ford commercial. And I remember there was a new production team on it, a new production manager and coordinator. Okay. And they asked if I was available. And I was like, yeah. Because I didn't have any other prospects. I was definitely available. So I went on to do that. And then, you know, just kept, I got in the mix that way. That's really how it all began.
Sure. And this is all here in New York, yeah?
Yep, all in New York.
Once you finished your first job and you did your first few jobs and you kind of got the ball rolling, did you encounter any kind of like mentors throughout your career that kind of like, especially early on, that kind of got you to really focus on a certain part of production or just think about your career long-term or, you know, stuff like that?
It's such a good question. I wish the answer was yes. I didn't really have any formal mentors in terms of my training, and I don't now. And I think that's a real like absence. Yeah. And I can tell that if I did, I would be able to accelerate, you know, what I'm up to even more. Informally, in terms of mentorship, I would say, yeah, there was a producer at a production company called Tractor. His name is Rainey Melendez, and he's still somebody I look to for guidance. And he was somebody who I would say was a mentor, more in the sense that he saw in me, he saw me to be someone greater than I even knew myself to be. Like he believed in my capacities more than I did. So when I was making that transition from like being a coordinator to a production manager, remember there was a big job, a union job, and it seemed so intimidating to me. And I was like, I can't possibly production manage a job like this. And he was like, yes, you can. And he knew that I could, even though I didn't know that I could.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I feel like that's what the best mentors do, is really, I think, like allow, give you the you know, what does it give you? The awareness and the strength and the willingness to stretch yourself. And Rainey's definitely done that for me.
And you still keep in contact, I guess, with your guy, Rainey?
My man, Rainey. Yes. Okay. So like a few months ago, I was in LA and I was having like a breakdown, a nervous breakdown, not an extreme nervous breakdown. I was having some issues with the company. You know, it's not easy being a business owner, you know. I'm sure everybody out there who owns a company, you understand there's a lot of challenges that the world doesn't prepare you for. And I was kind of like freaking out. And so I went to Rainey's house and he's like, do you have an organizational chart? And I was like, no. And so we were eating, oh my gosh, what is that? What's that Mexican place that everyone loves that it's like real, Chipotle. Okay. We were eating Chipotle.
Okay.
Okay. That's authentic. Sorry, no product placement from Chipotle, but I was at Rainey's house and I was sitting there with him and like on a napkin, he drew out a whole organizational chart and really helped me think through the business model. And that was just a few months ago. And I still use that. And I constantly am looking to him because he's so much further along in his career. When I have challenges, I definitely go to Rainey. Usually when I'm in a moment of crisis.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So when you're in production, there's like a million different fields that you can kind of go into and specialize in. How did you fall into like producing and what made you kind of fall in love with producing? I've tried producing before. It's a fucking nightmare. Schedules, budgets, numbers. It's so hard. I don't know what people see in it, but I'm curious to know what about producing did you kind of gravitate towards?
See, I had the total opposite experience. That's why it's so interesting because everybody has their personality traits, right? Like when I got into the office and everything was so organized, it was totally a match for who I had been my whole life. Like in sixth grade, my sixth grade history teacher used to photocopy my notes and hand them out to the whole class because they were so organized.
Wow.
Like I'd be hanging out with friends and they're like, what should we do? I'm like, I don't know. Should we make a list of things we could do? And people are like, what? No, why would we do that? I'm like, oh, okay, never mind. But when I got in the production office, like list making and being organized and color coding, like all these things that made my soul expand were exactly a match for being in the office. And so I felt like, unlike you, I had found my home as soon as I got there.
It's funny. When you look at my computer's desktop, it's just like a jumble of folders within folders of just pictures and PDFs and all this stuff. So I definitely don't have that, those strengths that you have.
That's I don't know. I see the Rubbermaids behind you. They look pretty organized.
That's all my wife's doing. I had nothing to do with that. I have two Pelicans in here, which are mine, which are probably still a mess, but everything besides that is not my doing.
Got you.
But it's okay. So 2014, you started your own production company called The Light. How did that come about? What made you want to start your own production company?
I had been freelance line producing for a while, and I think I just started to get a little, you know, itchy as we do to see what's next. I think that's the thing with the hierarchy of production, or you know, in our industry, there's often places to move up to, but then when you get to the top of that place, and sometimes you're looking elsewhere, where do I go next, right? Or becoming a gaffer, you want to become a DP or maybe a director. And I think I was at that place with being a freelance line producer. So I was interested in maybe starting a company, and I was thinking about doing it with three men that I knew, another producer and two directors. And it just didn't really take. Everyone was so busy. And I thought that was at the time, that was the only way I could see starting a company because I had no clients. I couldn't take clients from the production company where I was working. And I didn't see any way that I could just bring in income other than partnering with people who had access to that. But then I ended up thinking, well, let me just start the company. That way, when we need it will be there. So I called a lawyer friend. I started the company. And then things started very, very small. I started getting calls for jobs. And I said, oh, can I run this through my company? The person said, sure, no problem. And slowly, I started to do, you know, small productions and then build it up from there. And I definitely didn't have a vision for creating a big production company when I started at all. That was not my intention. But it started to grow, and you know, I'm a very spiritual person, and I conveniently named my production company The Light. And so when it got to the point where I felt that tension between my freelance career and actually just diving in fully, I asked myself the question, like, okay, well, do you trust The Light? well, okay, I trust the light. So I just decided to go for it fully. And then that's really when things started to take off. And I'd say things really started to expand in the past year more than they had in the 5 years, you know, leading up to it.
Hmm.
Takes a while.
Like just this past year, you say?
Yes.
Wow. That's cool. That's amazing. Yeah. I see like a lot of production companies just from, yeah, from pre-COVID to post-COVID, so many of them have kind of come to a close or spun off into something different. And it's, there's so many things changing, I think, right now with so many different production companies. So I'm glad to hear that you guys are still there and you're still, you know, growing and expanding. So congratulations.
Me too. Thank you. Me too.
So, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work with Light as a crew member, and it's, I can honestly just say that it's like, it's something that I don't experience with any other production companies. You do so many different things, but you consciously do them differently, and it really kind of shows, like whether it's on in the final product or just in people's attitudes on set. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to kind of reinvent the way production is done day to day?
So when I started the Light, I thought a lot about this idea of what would it be like to brand the production experience? Like, what would it be like to, when you were on set with the Light, you knew you were on set with the Light. You weren't like, wait a minute, is this another production company? There was something different about it. So when I started with that question, well, then I started to think about, okay, well, what would that be? What would it mean to brand the production experience? And at the time I had already been doing like green sets for many years. So I thought, okay, it would mean that the set was sustainable. There was sustainability was a key aspect of the production experience. And then I thought, well, signage, right? Like certain kind of branded signage would give you a sense that you are on set with the Light. And then as I started to think about it even more, I got curious about like, well, wait a minute, like where does the way that we do production now even come from? Like, where does it come from? Mm-hmm. Like, why do we prep, shoot, and wrap the way we do? Why do we call it prep, shoot, and wrap? Why do we have a key grip and a sound mixer and a gaffer? Like somebody created that. And I got really curious about looking into the origins of the system. So I spent several years really researching that, going back, reading articles, reading books about the labor side of Hollywood, about the production side, about where the process that we have came from. And I found that largely it was based after the factory, which is not a surprise if you've been on set, and really the military, which is why so much of our language is violent. You know, we say run and gun or, you know, shooting and shotgun mic and all this kind of stuff. The language is saturated in that inner vibe, right?
Combative, yeah.
So I thought, okay, well, this is really interesting. This is where it comes from. And then I realized that even though the technology of filmmaking has completely changed in the past 100 years, that actually the production process hasn't been meaningfully challenged or modernized in all of those years. And I started to think about my own experience on set of being, you know, yelled at by ADs or crying in the bathroom or, you know, missing a birthday party because I was just on set so late, or just the culture of filmmaking. And I thought, like, there's got to be another way. And I think also like a way to bring more feminine energy into the whole process. So as I started to explore that, that's when I thought, okay, well, this is what I can do with the Light. I can experiment with these kinds of ideas. I can experiment with a different kind of culture, a different kind of process. How can we, a different kind of language, really looking at how can we create a production experience where people feel good when they leave and not bad?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the first things that jumped out at me for the first job that I ever did with you guys was the name tags. I thought that was such a simple, you know, thing to do on set, where each person's assigned a name tag, and throughout the day they just, you know, walk around with these magnetic name tags. And it's something so simple, but like you remember the production assistant's name, you remember the sound engineer's name, you remember the producer's name, you remember everyone's name, and you get to like know them a lot more intimately. Where if you're just walking around without name tags, you may know that person's a sound engineer because they're holding a boom, but you really have no other understanding of who that person is. And just I think like knowing that person's name and being able to call out to them and say, hey, Michelle, or hey, John, like it just builds that level of intimacy with the people that you're working with. Can you talk a little bit about that? How did that come about, I guess, implementing the name tags?
Yeah. And I think, you know, just to build off what you were saying about seeing somebody with a you know, a boom mic or headphones and knowing that's a sound mixer. It takes a certain level of sophistication and experience in the industry to even know that too, right? Like I remember so many times being on set and like not knowing who the fuck anybody was, right? Like I had to figure that out. Like, okay, like the electrics, yeah. The electrics are usually wearing glasses and they like look a little nerdier and they have gloves. Okay, if there's somebody who's like more like brawl, you know, brawler, it's probably a grip. Like all the things that I had to learn over the years in terms of how identifying people, it comes with experience. And I think that like, if you're just starting out on set, it's very like daunting to figure out who people are in that way. And I think that the thing with the name tags was really coming from the lens and the framework of how do we humanize the production experience? Because so much about the way that it was built in the past was really around human beings being cogs in an industrial machine. Like it doesn't matter what your name is at all, and it matters what your role is. And that was actually a big difference from the way that work had been organized before the Industrial Revolution, because it was much more organized around, you know, your name is Thomas. Like I have a relationship with you. You're a welder. Like our clients, the client and the worker, like had, there was an autonomy and an individuality in that way. And like you had control over your own work. But then when, you know, when the factories started, it became a very different approach to work where they really looked at people more like machines. And so if you broke down, you were out and they just brought in another person.
It's really interesting. I never thought of it like that, but it's so true that, you know, thinking back to pre then and now it's, and when you're in a factory, there's just that disconnect between the end user and the person creating it. And, you know, just again, by understanding people's names, it breaks down that barrier and allows for people to kind of know each other a little bit better.
Exactly. And it makes it relevant that you're a human being, that you have a name, you have, you know, dietary restrictions, you have things that you're passionate about and a history, and that there is a 3D you as a human being who's a crew member. So a lot of what we do is really around like teasing out people's individuality and celebrating that. And the name tags is one way that we do that on set.
Sure. That's one way, but it's not my favorite way. My favorite way is the call sheets that I get. I always know that I'm working with the light, because when you send out the call sheets, it has everyone's picture and they submit their pictures ahead of time. And when you get the call sheet the night before, it has everyone's picture next to their names. And again, that's another really great way to just know who I'm going to be working with. Instead of having to go through a list of like 30 names, I could just see people's pictures. So when I get to set, I already know that she's the production assistant, or he's the AD, or she's the director. Again, it's just a really good way to get people to know who each other are and just stimulate kind of interaction between people and breaks down that level of strangeness. Is that a word?
It is now.
But yeah, anyway.
Yes, absolutely. And I think also like, you know, what happens a lot is that in the traditional sense, like, well, everyone will know who the director is, right? Or the stars, or the people who are at the quote unquote top. And they won't necessarily know what the PA looks like or what the third grip looks like. And I think that when we do something like the way our call sheet is, it's like everybody's face is on the call sheet. You know, and the other thing about the way that we organize it is we organize it by call time. So what that does is it brings often the PAs in production who are in the earliest to the top of the call sheet. So the director may be on page 3, you know, and I think that is a big part of why we do that also, because at some point looking at the traditional call sheet with all of its boxes and its hierarchy, it just felt so antithetical to our brand and what we're about that it felt like we just couldn't even use it anymore. So having people's photos in circles, you know, this different principle of organizing felt much more aligned with what we're up to. And also just this idea of like challenging the status quo, like, who says the call sheet has to look that way? Like, I know it's the way it's always looked, but is it the way it always has to look? Like, I don't know, maybe not.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, when I think of like websites, back in like the 90s, there was something called GeoCities, and there were these boxy websites with like basic graphics. But nowadays, when you go to people's websites or their Facebook pages, they're super interactive, they're media rich, you can see photos and just get a much richer experience of reading a screen as opposed to, you know, 20 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. But, you know, I think that's carried over to your call sheets too, where they're not just like Excel spreadsheets. They're just really visual and very interactive, and it forces people to not just read, but really experience and enjoy getting the call sheets. So yeah, I think it's you and your team are doing a great job doing that stuff.
Thank you. It's so nice to hear the positive feedback, because we get a lot of negative feedback too. That people are like, I just need the box and the time. I don't want to see all this, rest of this.
Sure.
So thank you.
Well, I've always thought you do a good job. The first page has like the location, the call time, and then everything else below it, it's just like fun stuff. It's like candy. but all the important facts rise to the top, and I can, digest that super easily. But yeah, another thing that I've also noticed about your productions specifically is something that you call the ICU note. Can you just go into a little bit detail about what it is and why you and your team have chosen to like implement it into your day-to-day sets?
Absolutely. So ICU, and we think of it as ICU, like ICEU, is something we do on set where we give every crew member a piece of paper with another crew member's name on it. And it's their job to watch that other person throughout the day in a not creepy way, hopefully, and really find something that they can acknowledge them for. And they write it on the piece of paper, we collect it, and then at the end of the day, we pass them back out to everybody. So before you leave set, you receive a note with your name at the top and an acknowledgement that somebody has written about you, right? And what's so special about that too is that it's anonymous. So you feel like almost like anybody could have written that. And the reason that we do that is again, inside of this framework of individuality, of celebrating people, of recognizing and appreciating the unique contribution that everyone brings to set. And also just bringing it into our hearts. We can so often be in the grind and in our mind, and there's something really special about getting a note where someone sees you, like really sees you, and can acknowledge that. It feels really good to receive one. Right? Am I right? Did you like your ICU note?
So the first time you mentioned it and it was brought up on set, my initial thoughts were like, this is so corny. Oh my God. Cause like you said, like you're thinking about the next day's job and you're still recovering from yesterday's job. And it's just one of those weird things that you get thrown at on your shoots. And, I just quickly jotted something down throughout the day and gave it to someone. But when I got the note that someone had written about me, it was really weird. It was like getting a note from like a secret admirer, someone that like, it didn't have the person's name, but it just had a bunch of like little scribbles of like what they observed me doing and them complimenting. And I honestly, like I felt so good about like when, after I finished reading that, I was like, wow, this complete stranger who I don't know who wrote this, but they noticed that I was actually working. And I was working hard, and you just feel much, much better after it. And since then, like I've told other producers about it, and every time I work with you guys, I always look forward to getting the note at the end of the day. So it's something really cool, and I hope that other productions copy.
Thanks. That's good to hear. And I think, all this stuff, it's like there are things that we're doing now, and who knows, like 2 years from now, maybe we won't do that anymore. And we don't do that on every production either. It takes some discernment to know which production that's right for. Because it really works well when you're on a production that's in one place where you have more time and it's a smaller crew. If it's a massive job and you're doing location moves, nobody wants to be bothered with that. There's other things that we do sets. We have other kinds of activities, but I like getting my ICU notes too. I save them all in a pile. I have them all for if I'm feeling down, I just look at them.
They're great. I really do like them. Okay, so March 13th, coronavirus arrives in New York, shuts everything down, at least for a lot of the industry and so many other industries. How did everything play out for you guys, and how did you pass the time?
Yeah, great question. I just went into a flashback dark hole. So we were on set. We actually were filming on March 13th. So we were filming on March 11th and March 13th. And you could just feel the difference between March 11th. March 11th, we were like, I don't know. Maybe this will be a thing. And then by March 13th, it's like, whoa, should we even be here anymore? Like, this is something feels off here. But we finished up that production. And then, I think like everyone, we thought, oh, this will last a month or do, but obviously, spoiler alert, lasted a lot longer.
Sure.
And during that time, I was very fortunate in that we had a very small team at that time. So we were able to really hunker down. We didn't have a lot of overhead and we were very nimble in that way. So we hunkered down. And we also used that opportunity to really develop some ideas that we had been building around workshops. Like workshops on Zoom, having panels, talking about race, talking. We had a panel of, you know, Black creatives and technicians talking about what it's like to work in this industry. We had also a workshop where a gaffer and a key grip talked about what's the difference between being an electric and a grip, and really use that time to offer some, you know, educational and thought-provoking programs on Zoom. And then, yeah, we just hunkered down and waited. And I think production came back for us. We had something in July in Ohio. And then really in August, September, things started picking back up.
Cool. Yeah, I'm glad it didn't take too long. I still to this day hear people that are like, yeah, this is my first day back on set. And I'm like, wow, this is way bigger than I thought it was. And yeah, like for me, for sure, like I thought it was going to be a couple weeks, to be honest with you. I thought it was like it was going to come and go like a rainstorm and blow over. But I just kept looking at the calendar, like go like 1 week after the next. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to really suck.
So rough. Yeah. And I think also the thing though about being in production is that, you know, I've been back around people like you have for many months. And I'm sure many of you out there have. But I have I went, you know, I was in LA recently and I went out to dinner with somebody and they were like, this is the first time I've been out to dinner like since for a year and a half. Or this is the last time I've been around people for a year and a half. And I was like, oh, wow, it's different. I think if you work in a job where you're working from home or your office is closed down, but being on set, as soon as we went back to set, I was around people again. You know, we work in an industry that's so people focused. You know, we can't do what we do from home.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, you know, when people kept saying like, we're going to try to work socially distance, I'm like, that might be possible if you're doing an outdoor job, maybe. But in New York, when you're shooting indoors in such small apartments and offices and small businesses, it's like it's so hard to remain more than a foot away from other people, let alone 6 feet.
Absolutely.
So I just thought that was interesting how it played out. But yeah. So yeah, you mentioned, I guess, that you were doing some workshops and a lot of them were based on, I guess, like gender and ethnicity in the industry. One thing that I've noticed that when I work with your production company is that a lot of the, like most of the crew is very balanced. There's never like too many dudes or too many women or too many white people. How important is that to you to have like a balanced crew in terms of gender and ethnicity?
Super important. Super, super important.
Yeah.
I just think that it's an ethical thing. It's also, I don't know, the way that the world looks, you know, at least you growing up in New York. And I think the way my world looks is that it's very diverse. There's people from all different kinds of backgrounds. And I think that it's very weird to go on to set when that's not the case, where it's like 99% one type of person, like obviously white people and also like often men. I mean, I've worked on so many productions where I was the only female and many productions where there was absolutely, it was 100% white people, including myself. And so I think that there's, you know, it's very important to us to have, you know, a diverse crew. And also, you know, our thing isn't just about having a diverse crew. It's really about creating an inclusive process so that we're all the people that we're bringing into that set, well, how are we actually including them in the process instead of just plugging, you know, people who've been historically left out of the system into the same exact system that was always there that was excluding them in the first place. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. The past few years, I've been in the industry now for 13 years or so. And when I started, it was 95% men on every job. And now it's changed a lot more, but still, it's not, I wouldn't say it's 50-50 yet. But I have noticed a lot more women on set. And I never really thought about it until the past couple of years. I've been on some shoots where it's an all-woman set and I'm the only guy. And at lunchtime, I'm like looking around, it's very awkward to be the only guy on set. And it just makes me realize man, women have had it so hard because this has been the norm for them for so many decades now, or more than a century. So it's a weird place to find yourself where there's no one else that looks like you around other people. Not that anyone's bad, but it's just strange to feel alone. So yeah, I appreciate producers and productions that kind of make a conscious effort to level the playing field and include people from, you know, from all walks of life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. So when I was doing research for this interview, I went on your website and I was poking around on there and I saw an area called stats. And the stats area, it shows the gender and racial makeup of your production crews. Where did you get the idea to create this? And then whose idea was it to share this data with people that are visiting your website?
I got the idea because I had, you know, in my research, I'm very interested in those kinds of metrics. And I found that, you know, the Annenberg Institute, there's really amazing people and institutions out there that are doing that kind of work on data when it comes to like features and episodic and things like that. And often when it comes to talent, actors, and then the quote unquote above the line crew. I don't personally like that term because I think it's above the line and below the line is actually like really offensive, but it's the way that we speak about it. And I found that it was nearly impossible, actually 100% impossible in terms of what I was able to find that kind of information when it came to short form production, when it came to commercials and promos. I couldn't find any information on those statistics out there. And so I thought, okay, well, we have to start putting those together because we can't get better at something if we don't know where we're at. We have to first understand where we're at as an industry when it comes to those numbers, and particularly when it comes to crew, when it comes to the 90% of the people who are working, not just the director and, you know, the writer or the actor. Mm-hmm. Like, what about all the technical crew, all the people that are there in production? And so I thought, okay, we need to start measuring this. And then transparency is so much a part of what we're about. I mean, I think for me, my goal is really around transforming the whole industry. It's not about making a lot of money as a production company and then like, you know, cackling as I count my gold coins. And so transparency is a big part of our model in general. Like I really, I'm all about sharing that information. And sometimes those numbers are actually like really humiliating. Like when we do a production, we recently did a production in Virginia and it was embarrassing to see that those statistics because it was like 95% white people and like probably 90% men. And that's so antithetical to our values, but it's also the reality of the production. And so I think it's important to be transparent about those kinds of statistics too, so that we can really start to understand where we're at and how we can do better.
Yeah, there's that old saying, like, you can't manage it unless you can measure it. And I think, you know, that's a great way to see and affect change is if you actually know what the numbers are. And I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I my hope in doing that too is that other production companies would do that, because I think that like we're just one production company. You know, we only have several hundred employees that like work with us every year. But I think if other production companies start doing this, then we can really look at, well, what does the industry as a whole look like? And that's going to create change. So I really, in terms of putting it on the website, it's put there to like as a beacon for people who are interested in this, and also as an invitation for other production companies to start doing this too, so that we can work together to improve the industry.
I wish there was some kind of like central organization that would actually capture that kind of data just to show people, you know, not just producers and production company owners, but like just crew in general, like what's the current state of, you know, labor measurements, I guess, in the industry. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I've always known and very much appreciated was that every time I work with The Light, I get paid within 24 to 48 hours, which is definitely not the norm. That's an outlier. Usually it's like a net 30, which is like you get paid 30 days after you do the job, sometimes a net 60, which is 2 months after doing the job. Why is this important to you as a producer and as a business owner?
I'm really glad to hear that you got paid that quickly, because that is our goal, but it does not always happen.
Okay.
So, but various reasons, but it absolutely is our goal, because I mean, I feel like it is, again, it's like comes to an ethical thing. Like I own a production company. That means that I get all the rewards that come with owning a production company, like the profit and all of that kind of stuff. So I should take all of the risk. This to me is like a fundamental belief that I have as a business owner. Like I get all the reward, I should take all the risk, and I should not have the crew waiting to get paid until I get paid from the client. Like that's unjust. It's not fair. So I often will pay the crew before we get paid from the client, by the client. And I think that's my responsibility as a business owner. I shouldn't be saying yes to a job unless I can pay the crew for that job before I get paid by the client.
Yeah.
And I just think it's not fair to ask somebody who's getting paid $250 a day to wait 2 months to get their paycheck. It's just wrong. So it's definitely a part of our whole model that people get paid quickly. Also in terms of what I was saying earlier, just, you know, recognizing, celebrating people and the crew. And another thing that we do is that we take 25% of our profits at the end of the year and we distribute it back to the crew. So that's another
I remember getting an email about that. So it's I've never been contacted by production after the fact saying like, hey, we want to send you some more money. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Exactly. And that's like, yeah, that for me is part of the same thing. Like our success is built, you know, together with the crews that we work with, and we shouldn't be having success if that's not going to be shared with the people who made that possible. So that's like one of my favorite things that happens all year long is like going to the, you know, taking this chunk of money and distributing it back to the crew based on how many days that they worked with us throughout the year. It's like, I can't wait until December. Sure. When we can do that.
And I guess, what kind of feedback have you gotten from your crews and from your clients after a shoot wraps? Do you find like you getting your, like, I guess, letters or, you know, emails and stuff like that from crew members and clients talking about their experience in the production?
Definitely. I have, you know, I receive a lot of positive feedback from people on set or after the fact about their experience. Just how different it feels, how they were treated, the experience they had on set, what that felt like. Also, you know, we receive negative feedback too. You know, that's part of it. We're really like challenging the status quo. And like, we receive, you know, people who, like you were saying, like people are like, this is corny, this is whack, I just want to work, this is stupid, right? And yeah, it's yeah, like, that's totally okay too. And we're very open to feedback. Like I'm very, I'm thrilled when people give us constructive feedback that we can continue to work into our model and in ways that we can improve. That's a big part of how we look at production, how we innovate. So it's always nice to get the positive feedback, but sometimes it's actually more helpful to receive the negative feedback too.
Yeah, no, for sure. I always tell my crews that I'm a huge fan of constructive criticism. I hate getting emails saying, hey, this sucked, or, you know, this is broken, but come at me and tell me why it sucked. So that way we can kind of work together to figure out, how do we improve that? How do we fix this problem? Not just for today, but moving forward, how do we improve our process? And yeah, I think constructive criticism, I think, is one of the best things that we can get as business owners and, you know, as people that manage other people in order to make everyone's life easier and better. You know, you were mentioning that, you know, you do make some mistakes, and I'm a little bit curious about that. Like what would you say throughout your career has been maybe one of your biggest mistakes, either on set or in your career? And what have you taken away from it? What have you learned from it?
Such a good question. It's a little tricky because I tend not to look at things that go down as like mistakes. I think I look at it as like, this was something to be learned from. There's a big mistake that I made recently on a job where I was so focused on the production. It was a very, very big job for a very big name client. And I was so focused on the production itself and on the production experience for the crew that I was not focused on the client's experience. And it was interesting because they had a session in which they gave feedback afterwards about working with the light. And they were mentioning a lot of things that I knew that they were not happy about in the moment. And the things that they were mentioning were actually, you know, kind of small, or they were production related things. And each one of those individually, I could have like explained away, but I realized it wasn't about the thing that they were pointing to exactly. It was about what was behind that, which was really interesting because they were all pointing to these production things that happen. And I realized, because it was coming from several of the people on the client, and there was something behind what they were saying, which is that they didn't feel like I was listening to them, and they didn't feel taken care of. Right. So it wasn't actually about the complaint at all. It was about the feeling behind that. And what I realized is that I could be much more focused on their experience and how they feel going through a job with us, which I was not thinking about at all, honestly. And so that was, you see, like, I don't know that I would frame that as a mistake necessarily, because I did the best that I could with what I knew at the time. So I think almost like a mistake sometimes is like, oh man, I knew better and I messed that up anyway. It's like, I didn't know any better, but now I do know better. And I know that I would approach that very differently moving forward. And it was actually quite hard to hear that feedback, because it was like quite searing. And it also made me like beat myself up a lot afterwards. But after I kind of moved through that phase of getting feedback, I realized there's such a huge lesson and opportunity for me inside of what they gave me a huge gift. Because now I'm not going to do that again in the future with them or with other clients. And I'm really going to level up my game And so I think that that would be an example of something where I, you know, I didn't know any better and I made a mistake, let's say. And then I really took something, a big lesson from it.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that's really tough as being a producer is because you have to make the crew happy, but you also have to make the clients happy. And just being that middle, you know, middle person in between, it's sometimes you can't dedicate as much attention to one because you're focusing on the other, and just trying to juggle those two needs is, I'm sure, really challenging on specific jobs, especially the bigger jobs. So I, from a crew point of view, I think you're still doing an amazing job.
Thanks. Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Okay, so most of the listeners, I won't say most, but a lot of the listeners that are listening to this podcast, they're just starting out their careers. And some of them may not know if they should just generalize or specialize in one thing, or, you know, do a variety of things. What's your take on it? Would you say try to specialize in something early on in your career, or just, you know, dip your toes in the waters, in different kinds of waters, and see what sticks and what, you know, which direction to run in?
Ooh, I'm so curious to hear what people say. Do you ask this question to everyone who's on your podcast?
No, this is the first time I'm asking.
Really?
This, actually, so.
Oh.
But if it's good, I may ask it for future people.
Definitely ask this, because I'm really curious to hear what people say. I'm very curious. I would say for myself, the advice that I received, which I took in, like made my own perspective, was really to, especially when I was first starting out, was to try everything. Was to try everything, because I wanted to be a director, and I, you know, it's so important to just know what every department does. You know what I worked in the wardrobe department. I knew I didn't want to work in the wardrobe department ultimately, but I did it because I was like, oh, let me just see what this is about. You know, I knew I wasn't going to be a script supervisor, but I took a script supervisor class, and I actually was like running around with like a stopwatch and a pencil for all. That is so hard. Shout out to all the script supervisors out there. That is not an easy job. And I think that the more that you can learn about all the different departments and what they do, the more that that's going to benefit you in your career, no matter what department you ultimately end up going into. And I also think it's so hard to do that after the fact. It's like, I'm jealous of all you getting out there, all you people out there getting started right now, because there's so many times it's like, oh, I wish I could just like be a grip for a day. But it's really hard as like an executive producer to like just suddenly like be a grip for a day. You know, it's hard once you get into a role to go back and try different things. And so I think like while you can, just try everything. Because how are you going to know what you like if you don't try it?
Yeah, it's kind of like college, where I feel like the whole college system is so backwards, because you have to pay so much money and specialize in one thing when you're 17 or 18 years old, and you haven't really had any experience besides, like, you know, the immediate sphere of growing up for 17 years, 18 years. So, you know, I really applaud, like, when I see Germans and Australians backpacking on like all corners of the earth, because they're really out there between college and high school, feeling the world out and to see what they want to really specialize in. And I think, you know, that's the way to do it. I think, you know, me personally, I switched majors twice, and I lost a lot of money. I lost some time. You know, I made some good friends along the way, but still it's really hard for you just to jump in and specialize in something that you know very little about.
Totally. What did you major in to begin with?
So I was an actor, and, you know, again, that was really, really fun, but wasn't for me. And I tried economics, but again, I suck with numbers. So I got out of that. I was like, oh, it's an easy way to make money. As soon as I realized you had to actually know math, I was like, yeah, not for me.
See, I was just like, I could smoke weed and eat popcorn all day. Like, I'll go to film school. That's basically exactly 18-year-old me. That was how I based my decisions. And here I am now, all these years later.
Yeah, after my first like 3 or 4 film classes, I'm like, wait, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to graduate just for watching these like cool movies at like, you know, 10 in the morning. Amazing.
Exactly.
So definitely the right choice. Okay, so technical expertise or attitude. What are the characteristics that you place the greatest emphasis on when you're crewing up for your productions?
Attitude, 100%. 100%. Because I think that like when... In my experience, at least, when I find people who have great energy, and I would call attitude energy, same thing. You know, like when I find people who have great energy, they 9 times out of 10 are amazing at their job as well. Because I think those things go hand in hand. So often when I'm doing travel jobs, I'll crew up according to that. Like I'll find a local production manager, and I'll be like, okay, this is how we're going to do it. We're only going to work with people who have great energy. So people that you like being on set around, like people who you like being around on set. I don't want a grumpy sound mixer, like want someone who's cool. And then I've also just found that by hiring that way, that cool sound mixer is going to be a good sound mixer. I don't think I've ever had it where I hired someone who I thought was had a great attitude and good energy, and they just were not good at their job technically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Cool. And also, I was doing a little bit of research on you, and I saw that you started a non-for-profit called Globetops. Can you tell me a little bit about what it is and how it came about?
Yeah. So in 2012, I started this nonprofit called Globetops, like you said. And what we do is we connect people who have laptops they don't use anymore with someone around the world who needs a laptop. So that was the original idea. And, you know, there's profiles of people in 8 different countries, all who need laptops for different reasons. And the donor, so let's say you get a new computer and you're not sure what to do with your last one, you can go on the website and you could choose who to give your computer to. So you may see like, you know, a rapper in Haiti and be like, oh, I want to give them my laptop. Or you may see like, you know, an eye surgeon in India and be like, oh, I want to give them a laptop. Like, I also had eye surgery, so I really resonate with that cause. So the idea is that the donor gets to choose where their laptop goes. And then really in March of last year, like you were mentioning, when COVID hit, we were very fortunate to have been so equipped to be able to get laptops in the hands of, like, particularly New York City school kids who needed them for remote learning. So we tripled our distribution in 2020, and we gave out hundreds of laptops to kids who needed them for remote learning. And we're continuing right now to mainly focus on New York City schools and kids who need them here, because the digital divide is so massive.
Yeah. I have some friends who are teachers, and they were telling me, working in some of these schools, like, you'd be surprised, you know, us as filmmakers, when we're on set, everyone has like a laptop, but when you go to certain neighborhoods, like, nobody has them. Like, even at home, they don't even have like desktop computers. And to me, that's like mind blowing. I can't believe that in New York that people are like that, you know, that don't have technology, which we consider like basic necessities day to day. So it's amazing that there's organizations like yours that are actually doing that and know that that exists and are doing something to make it to make a difference. So
thanks. And yeah, the thing is that there's a lot of people just have multiple laptops sitting around in their house, not sure what to do with them, right? Because if you get a new computer, you don't just
this guy right here.
You know, we're gonna have to talk, Tom, about that.
That's
because
right.
You don't know what to do with your last one, right? You can't just throw it in the trash, and so you just put it in a drawer in the closet or in a Rubbermaid, and then it just sits there. But it's actually been estimated that up to 50% of the e-waste that ends up in landfills is actually still usable. And the crazy thing is that it goes into landfills in places and in communities where they could actually use those electronics in their, you know, complete format, but instead they're being burned, and then the metals are being extracted because they have value. And it's like, well, why are we burning laptops that people could be using? Oftentimes laptops just need a new battery, or they're, you know, they can be simply refurbished and they still have more life left in them. So that's really what Globetops is about, is about closing the digital divide and then also doing it in a way that's like environmentally friendly.
That's amazing. I'm definitely going to reach out to you, because I know of 2 laptops sitting just collecting dust in a drawer.
We'll find them a good home. We'll find them a good home.
So you're from New York, you've been working in New York for so many years. What would you say are some of the best resources that are available to filmmakers here in New York that people may not know about?
Well, I'm a big fan of the Made in New York program. So the Made in New York PA training program, I taught there for many years. I just think that's an amazing resource for people who are looking to get into the film industry, to be trained by like top tier professionals and to come out of that program really knowing how to be a good PA, which is something that I certainly didn't learn in film school. And then they have, you know, job placement ongoingly after that in terms of placing PAs in production roles and features and episodic and commercials. And so I think that's an awesome program.
It's called Made in New York.
You don't know about Made in New York?
Yeah. I've seen their logo, but I don't know too much about it, but I've seen like their like black and white logo sketched on like trucks and on billboards and stuff like that. That's from like the mayor's office or something?
Exactly. That Made in New York stamp that you're talking about is the mayor's office of film and TV. And then they have inside of that, they have programs. So Made in New York, the PA training program is one of them. I think they also have a post-production program that they started in terms of people training people to be editors. And it really takes New Yorkers who may not have opportunities to get into the film industry in other ways, and it trains them to become production assistants. So it trains them how to be, you know, do petty cash, how to talk on the walkie, how to, you know, what, how to do a lockup,
sure,
all those things that, you know, are very practical. And I remember I started working with the program back in 2005. I worked on a movie called I Am Legend, and we had like an insatiable need for PAs. Like I was hiring about 150 PAs every day to do these massive lockups. And at the point that you're hiring 150, 200 PAs, you have basically like 30 PAs and the rest are just like friends or cousins. And you're like, do you have a pulse? Great, you're hired. Sure. Please come with me. You're gonna be the PA today.
Here's a walkie.
Like, the Made in New York PA training program. It was such one of the early cycles came to visit on set and they were so good. And they think they graduated on a Thursday and on Friday I hired the whole class. And within a week they had become the leaders of all the other PAs. Like they had become in charge of all the other PAs. I was like, this training program, it's amazing. So I've been a big fan of that from the beginning.
Okay. So that pretty much wraps up most of the questions that I had. What's the best way for people to find you online?
I would love it if your listeners found me online. That'd be great. You can find us at thelight.nyc. We're also at The Light Is Lit on Instagram. Yeah, hit us up. We'd love to hear from you.
Globetops, does that have a website? It has a website, I know.
It is globetops.com. So you can also find us if you have a laptop to give, or actually if you know anybody or you yourself need a laptop, feel free to contact us at globetops.com. And we're also at globetops on Instagram.
Amazing. Okay. Well, very cool. Well, thank you so much for jumping on today, answering all these questions. I greatly appreciate it. I'm sure the audience is also at home clapping. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I absolutely, like I said, I absolutely adore you. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me on.
All right. We'll see you on set.
See you on set.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This week's episode is sponsored by my lighting company, MasterShot Films. Since 2008, thousands of productions have entrusted the MasterShot team to deliver and operate all of the lighting equipment for their interviews, branded content, and social media videos. Our gaffers and key grips deliver anywhere in the tri-state area. Visit MasterShotFilms.com to see a virtual tour of our G&E vans and to see some BTS videos of our lighting setups that we've lit over the years. Save 10% on your first booking by using the promo code NYCVideoPodcast. Okay, so that just about wraps up today's conversation with Becky Morrison. It was great to learn about how she came up in the industry, how she started her own production company, and more importantly, how she and her team are systematically working towards making film sets more inclusive and uplifting experience rather than just another job. Just the simple act of having crew members wear name tags really breaks down a lot of social barriers and allows me to remember the names of various crew members that are running around and that I'm working alongside of. If you're a filmmaker and you want to learn more about Becky and her team at The Light, you can check out their website or follow them on social media, which I'll throw down in the show notes of this episode. Also, if you have an old laptop laying around, be sure to check out Becky's non-for-profit Globetops to help out others who are in need and can really benefit from such a gift. If you're based here in New York and you want to stay informed about industry news and gain indispensable advice from some of your peers, be sure to subscribe and rate our show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as this will help others find the show in their feeds. You can follow us on Instagram to see past guests and listen to episodes based on your specific area of interest. If you have any questions or you'd like to explore a particular theme on the show, DM us on Instagram. And finally, if you're interested in running a sponsored ad for your business or you'd like to be a patron of one of our episodes and engage with the New York film and video production community, amazing. Shoot us an email at nycvideopodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, I'm Tom Chavez. This is the NYC Video Podcast, and I'll see you on set.